On the Nonlinear Healing Podcast, we talk about all the aspects of healing. The beautiful parts and the painful parts, too. We acknowledge that healing is not linear, and there are many ups and downs in every person's story. And in fact, we celebrate the messy parts just as much as the pretty parts. This is Nonlinear Healing with Courtney Brooke. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Nonlinear Healing with Courtney Brooke. I'm your host, Courtney Brooke. I hope you all have been enjoying the milder weather. I know I sure have. Although it's been a little unpredictable, we experienced a windstorm yet again. And I am thinking of all of those who've been affected, along with those in other parts of the U.S. who've been affected by tornadoes and other disasters. I am certainly recognizing that this is a lot different than I think I've witnessed in past years. And taking a little bit of extra care to ground myself, because that all just makes you really uncomfortable. Environmentally, I have been working to leave a smaller footprint and just been cultivating more awareness around all of that. So I just want to encourage you all that if you are not maybe taking those steps to reduce your footprint and to help combat some of these changes, these climate changes that we're seeing, I certainly encourage you to like look a little bit more into it and be a little bit more proactive. So I am super excited to dive into Kathy Jean Francois's interview today. But before I hop in, I want to make a couple of announcements. So first and foremost, I want to address the fact that I have been working really hard to try to have at least a third of my guests from the BIPOC community, so the Black, Indigenous, Persons of Color community. And the reason for that is that I am an anti-racist. And what it means to be an anti-racist means that you don't take a passive role. You recognize the systems of oppression that are in place and you actively work to dismantle them. So there is a large underrepresentation of the BIPOC community within the podcast network group. There's also just in media in general. So I am being proactive and thoughtful about making sure that they're represented on my podcast. I want all persons to be able to hear parts of their story in my podcast. And it's extremely important to me that persons of color also feel recognized here. So I know I've had people reach out to me on social media and try to challenge me and tell me that it is quote unquote racist to seek out BIPOC guests. And what I will tell you is that it is the opposite of that. It is an anti-racist tactic. So expect at least a third of my guests to be from the BIPOC community, but I'm truthfully aiming for closer to about half to help balance out the vast underrepresentation that I've witnessed. So also, I want to address the fact that we are missing a podcast interview. So last week I dropped an interview with my dear friend Kara, and it was a very difficult decision for her, but we have decided to remove that episode. Rest assured, friends, that we will be re-recording that episode. It will be available in the future. So just be patient and bear with us while we get all of that arranged. It's a very moving story. It's a very important story to share. And it was a very emotional interview that just feels best to redo. So no, you're not crazy. If you tuned in last week, it was there and now it's not. But once again, we will be re-recording. So just stay tuned. Next, I'd like to announce a few of the events that we have going on over the next month. So speaking of difficult decisions, I wanted to also just reiterate, in case you didn't listen to last week's episode, that I made the difficult decision to scale back on the Exhale group. We had expanded to a total of 3 locations, but I need to refocus. And truthfully, time and energy are simply not infinite resources. In fact, they are the most finite resources that we have. And I need to redistribute my time and energy a little bit more. So I have decided to just focus my time and energy into the space in Greensburg as our home base for the Exhale group. Truthfully, all of the satellite locations that we had had are within a 30-minute drive of the space, and I think that is very doable. So we'd love to have you join us. We will be meeting at the space on the 27th, so that'll be April 27th at 6:30. Weather permitting, it'll be our first group meeting again in the yard. So hopefully we can all meet outside and enjoy a nice evening together. We'd love to have you. Also coming to the space again this month is the Spirituality 101 group. This month, we're going to be diving into human design. If you don't know what human design is, it is a newer modality, and it's a blend of astrology, the I Ching, the Kabbalah, and the chakra system, where astrology is a really great insight into patterns psychologically, individually. I kind of think of human design as the quote-unquote rule book or the directions for how to do life based on your energy type. So I have found it incredibly useful for me in my decision making and in giving me guidance from the day to day. And I would love to share that with you. So make sure you drop by. That'll be on Sunday, April the 30th at 10 a.m. at the space in Greensburg. New this month, we are introducing the Curio Coven at Miss Jones Curio in Greensburg, Pennsylvania. If you don't know what Miss Jones Curio is, it is one of the coolest oddities and curiosities shop in the Greensburg area. This is a group that came about so organically. I drop in there pretty regularly just to check it out. They always have cool books and cool decks and really neat different taxidermy things. So I was dropping in there and I'm always chatting about what's going on astrologically and what I have planned for my moon rituals and things coming up. And sure enough, there is a need. We've got a lot of baby witches in the area who are wanting to learn more about what it means to be a pagan. So for those of you who don't know, I am a pagan Christian, and I know, shock, blasphemy, according to a lot of people, but it's how I practice. And I am super excited to start this group where we are basically going to be healing the witch wound together and diving into paganism and what it means to be at one with the earth. So we're going to be talking about things like moon cycles, season cycles, the Sabbats. We'll be diving into candle spells and herbs. And this group is very much going to be experiential, where Spirituality 101 is very educational. This is a group where we're actually going to be doing practices together. So there is going to be a component to it that is educational, but then we're also going to be actually doing these things together. So we'd love to have you join. We are still working to finalize that date, but it's looking like it's going to be April the 23rd. We'll be meeting under the crescent moon, and we would love to have you there. Switching gears here, I'd love to tell you a little bit more about our interview today. For this interview, I got to sit and talk with Kathy Jean Francois, who is a writer, blogger, and high school English teacher. Kathy has a long history of depression, and she's been battling this illness with bravery and skill. I loved her story. I loved learning more about her. I found her very inspiring, and I'm sure you will too. So tune in with me for the story of nonlinear healing with Kathy Jean Francois. Welcome, Kathy, to the Nonlinear Healing Podcast.
Thank you so much for inviting me, Courtney. I'm excited to be here.
And I am so excited to learn more about your story and to share it with my audience. And to get us started, why don't you set the stage? Tell us a little bit about when you were born and a little bit about your household.
Okay, so I was born in the mid-1970s, 1974, and I was born with my twin sister. We are fraternal twins. We do have an older brother. There was my mom, dad, my older brother, and the two of us. And we are Haitian. My parents are both from Haiti, Haitian immigrants. We were raised pretty much in a Haitian household, although the you know, I kind of refer to myself as an Americanized Haitian, because even though my parents, you know, spoke our language Creole in the home, we responded to them in English. And being that we came to school, we went to school here in America, in Queens, we were sort of Americanized, and we didn't speak our language as much as I feel that we should have. And I, till this day, I regret that. But you know, our parents were fairly strict people. We understood, you know, what our job as children were. And by that I mean, you know, we had chores to do around the house, and if they were not done by the time my mom got home, we were in trouble. We understood that school was incredibly important, and if we did not do well, we would be punished. And so we grew up pretty much afraid of mostly my mom. My father was he was not as a disciplinarian as my mother was, but you know, we were kind of afraid of them. So I feel like, you know, I was so different from my sister in that I was always an introvert, and she wasn't. She was more of an extrovert. And whenever she wanted to go to parties, my mom would force me to go to a party as well, even though I didn't want to. And I knew that I couldn't do anything about it, because what my mom said went, and there was no disputing it. But I went with resistance, in the sense that I would give my sister the silent treatment, and I would stay in the corner by myself at a party. And I really hated to be at those functions, because I did not feel comfortable. It wasn't my choice to be there, and those were not my friends. And I just felt incredibly uncomfortable. And it wasn't until a few years later, well, many years later, that I realized that I did suffer with social anxiety on top of being an introvert. But even beyond that, I remember when I was, I'm going to say 11, going into the sixth grade. Yes, going into the sixth grade, we would spend time at my cousin's house, who lived up in Spring Valley, and we befriended the girl across the street. I forgot her name. And you know, we would often play with her. Excuse me, my dog is barking. Hold on. We would play with her outside the home. And there was one evening where she had her friends with her, and there were a group of boys as well. And we all decided to play, I believe it was hide and seek. And it was dark already. The moonlight was shining. The lamp lights were on. And I decided to go into my cousin's backyard, because it was right across the street from my cousin's. I went into my cousin's backyard so that I can find a place to hide. And one of the boys that was friends with that girl was in the yard with me. And he was like, "Come on here in the bushes. We can hide here." And I thought, okay, that's a good idea. All right, I'll hide with him. And he was standing behind me, and he had his hand. At first, his hands, I remember, were on my waist, but they gradually moved down, further down, where they should not be. And I remember feeling a little uncomfortable, like, whoa, you know. And so I, not even thinking that he's doing this on purpose, I just took his hands and I gently placed them back on my waist. And I said, "Just keep your hands here." And I continued to be on the lookout to see if there was anybody in front of me. Still, I wasn't thinking of anything about this boy who was standing so close behind me. And then his hands moved down again, where they should not be. And then when he did it the second time, he said, I remember this so well. He said, "Don't worry, I won't tell nobody." And immediately my heart like went up into my throat, and I was terrified. And this boy, I'm going to say I was about 11 or 12 years old, and he was probably my age, maybe 1 or 2 years older than me. And so I was very naive. I didn't know what was going on, but I knew that those words were not good. So I I removed his hands from me and I ran into my cousin's house. And there was my cousins, a few of the elders, they were in there talking. And I didn't, one of my cousins acknowledged me. She's like, "Hey, Kathy." And I don't know if I responded, but I considered for a second telling her what had happened, but there were too many people around. I didn't want to do that. So I went back outside in the front, not in the backyard this time. I went outside in the front under the lamplight. And I saw the girl who lived across the street. She was out there already. I don't know why. I told her, "I don't want to play anymore." And she was like, "Why?" And I said, and I contemplated not telling anything, but you know, as I come to learn, I just, I have diarrhea of the mouth sometimes. I just tell my story. So I just told her, I said, I told her what happened, that there was a boy in the back who grabbed me where he shouldn't have. And he told me that he wouldn't tell anybody. And she said, it was probably so-and-so, as if like, you know, no big deal. That was probably his thing, his way. And I saw him coming from where we were hiding. He had to climb the fence in order to come from the backyard and into the front of the house to the street. And so as I saw him approaching, I guess that anger and that shame inside of me, and the comfort of having other people around at this time, because everybody was starting to come back, all of that gave me that courage to step up to him. And I started hitting him, punching him all over his back. I said, "Don't you ever do that to me again." And everybody was just astounded. They were like, "What's going on here?" Some people laughed. Some people were shocked, didn't say anything. And immediately, I don't really remember what his response was. I just know that he and his friends, the other boys, they took off, they left. And I remember feeling incredibly proud of myself that I attacked him that way, that I stood up for myself that way. But after that moment passed and everybody went home to their respect, you know, everybody went home, and I stayed with my thoughts, and I just couldn't believe that that had happened to me. I couldn't believe that I allowed somebody to touch me. Why was I so stupid? Why didn't I see this coming? He and I were alone in the backyard. Why didn't I think that he was going to do something? Why was I so naive? So I was blaming myself. I was blaming myself a lot about what had happened, in a sense, like, well, he's a boy, he took advantage of the situation. That's what boys do. But I was blaming myself for having allowed that to happen. And I felt incredibly ashamed. And it was then, it was after that when I started feeling moments of depression, feeling very low, hating myself, always being angry with myself, and really not trusting the members of the opposite sex and being angry with them. And you know, just never liked boys after that. I remember specifically that a friend of mine, a really good friend of mine, Kristen, who was in the fifth grade with me, she had moved away, and we remained pen pals. And this happened shortly before going into the sixth grade. And I remember writing to her a letter telling her what had happened, and just berating myself, telling her how stupid I was, how dumb I was. I was so trusting, blah, blah, blah. And I remember her response saying, "Kathy, I've never heard you talk about yourself that way before." And, but, you know, despite the fact that I did stand up to this boy and I did tell other people what had happened, I didn't tell the right people because I didn't tell adults, right? But despite that, the shame of what had happened settled in, and I allowed it to overtake everything that I thought about myself. And I hated myself from that moment. I did.
Yeah. I'm wondering, I mean, you tell me, but I'm hearing that, like, essentially in that moment, despite doing everything in your power to advocate for yourself, to fight for yourself, to make sure that he understood, like, this is not okay, there was still this voice inside of you that was saying, like, you didn't do enough. You should have done more. You could have, you know, done this differently. And at least in my experience, what I find when I revisit those times in my life where I have that voice present, you know, a lot of times it seems like it's really somebody else right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's really like my parent or, you know, like whoever it was in my life that would maybe make me feel like that sometimes. Mm-hmm. And I remember you saying that, like, your mother was very strict and maybe had high expectations at some points. So, like, do you think there's any correlation there? Was there any chance that, like, that voice was maybe at least exaggerated or amplified in some way because of that?
I think so. My mother grew up in Haiti, and in Haiti, they have different disciplinary practices than they do here, right? And so she disciplined us, my sister, my brother, and myself, in pretty much the same way that I believe that she was disciplined. And it was really tough. And I always felt like my mother was out to get me, always. I always felt like if there's ever anything that my sister and I, which any chores that we had to do around the house, she would inspect my work much more and tell me what was wrong with it. I always felt like she was out to get me. So, and I never thought about how that might have correlated with the negative feelings I was feeling about myself. Maybe I was definitely being really hard on myself, but perhaps I was being hard on myself because I was used to my mother being hard on me. Not quite sure. I never correlated the two. But that incident was something that I would have never told her, because I feel like at that age, I felt like she would have probably been like, well, what were you doing back there in the backyard with that boy? You know, I don't know if she would have been very understanding. I just don't know. I don't want to say that she would have definitely reprimanded me. I just don't know, because I never gave her the chance, you know, by not telling her what had happened. But it's funny. I felt like that, even though, just like you said, it's not that I could have done more. It's just, I was angry with myself for having been in that situation in the first place. I was angry with myself for having been in that situation in the first place. So I just kept beating myself up over it. And even though my sister was there, I had told my sister about it. She was there when it happened, you know, when I was hitting him. And my sister later told me years later, she was like, at the time when I was angry about it and I was hitting him, my sister was like, what's the big deal? So he touched you in an inappropriate way, get over it, you know? And it's interesting that I probably felt at the time, because I don't really remember anymore. I probably felt at the time that I didn't really have anyone to talk to about it. Sure, everybody around who was playing that day knew what happened, but I didn't talk about my feelings about it to anyone until many, many years later. So it could have been a combination of what I thought my mom would say. It could have been a combination of how I felt about myself, what my mom would say, not having anyone to talk to about it, that really culminated in my years of depression and of myself hating myself, keeping away from boys. I've had so many problematic relationships with boys after that, which stemmed, I think, from my not being very trusting of myself when it came to boys and trusting other people. So I didn't trust myself when it came to boys, and I didn't trust them because I always felt like they were after one thing and they would do anything in order to get it, which I found it playing along that way with my later experiences with boys and my first boyfriend and how he took advantage of me and all that. So I felt like it was like a recurring thing because I did not talk about it and because I did not address it. I didn't face it growing up. It was something that happened to me and something that I won't forget. And I felt like I was okay after that. But looking back now, I realized that I feel like it clouded, it affected all the relationships that I've had since then. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And, you know, my background is I'm a therapist. I'm a behavioral health therapist. I'm an integrative therapist. And I think that sometimes those early experiences in our life, the analogy that I use is it's like when you're on a boat And, you know, at first, maybe like just being like, I don't know, 1 degree off, 5 degrees off, it doesn't really seem like it's that big of a difference. Mm-hmm. But then as you continue on your journey, you know, that 1 degree becomes 5 degrees, becomes 10 degrees, becomes mm-hmm. 20 degrees. And then at some point you're like, whoa, I am like way off base mm-hmm. from where I want to be. And that doesn't mean that we can't navigate back, but I certainly think that those early experiences, they do kind of change the trajectory of relationships and how mm-hmm. we view the world and all of that.
Yep. Yep. Completely agree. I totally agree. And I felt like because of that experience, it exacerbated my anxiety. It exacerbated my introvertedness and my social anxiety, and to the point where I couldn't control anything in my life, I felt, you know, until I finally started talking to a therapist, and that was through the help of my sister. You know, when we're in our 20s, this was a constant in my life. I was always crying over something. I was always giving people the silent treatment, always shutting myself off. I remember in the schoolyard, like eighth grade, people would be like, "Carmel, your sister's crying again." This was a constant, you know? And throughout my adult years, in even, like I said, with my first boyfriend who took advantage of me and my trust in him. And there was one point when we were in our, I want to say mid 20s, I was upset. I was crying over something, over apparently what I felt like was nothing, but whatever. And my sister was like, she looked at me, she's like, "I don't know how to help you." And so she just started searching. I don't even know if the internet was something. I think the internet had just become a thing. So she started looking for a therapist for me. She's the one who set that ball rolling for me to find a therapist, because she didn't know how to help me. She didn't know what to do for me. She understood that I was going through something. And there were times when she'd be like, "Okay, you need to stop." But at this point, she was just like, I can't take it anymore. You have to find help. And that's when I started my therapy journey, if you can call it that. And that was like off and on, because, you know, then I quit my job. I didn't have insurance anymore. And then I spent years trying to find another therapist. And then there were some years that I didn't find that I wasn't looking at all. And I thought that I could handle it on my own, but I didn't, I couldn't. And it's just a number of things happened until I finally got serious and got a new therapist about 7 years ago, who really dived deep into my feelings of anxiety and my feelings of worthlessness. And when I first met my therapist, I was talking about how I want to be married and I want a boyfriend and this and that. And now I'm looking back to that and thinking that it was like this desperation inside of me for some reason. And it's like through all the work that my therapist did with me, I was able to really think in times on my own, really evaluate situations and experiences and thoughts and feelings on my own without her, to the point where I realized where all of my depression stemmed from, because all these years I didn't understand that I was depressed. All these years I didn't understand why I went through what I went through. My social anxiety, I didn't know that that was a thing. I didn't know what it was. I always felt like a curse had been placed on me or something. And no lie, that's how I really felt. Like, there's something wrong with me. Somebody did something to me for me to feel this way. Feeling afraid to leave my home, feeling afraid to be in other, in social situations. I really felt like there was a curse placed on me. I didn't understand what I was going through. And through years of therapy and really thinking about what everything that I went through, it finally clicked into place. Oh my gosh, that thing that happened to me when I was 11 years old, that was the first time I ever experienced hatred for myself. Before that, I don't remember feeling that way about me. Yeah, I felt a little awkward in certain situations and I was an introvert. I kept to myself, but those feelings of hatred, that didn't occur before 12 years old. And so, yeah. And so all these years, and now, you know, I'm 48 years old, and it only registered maybe about in the last 2 years, literally.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
And so to take that information, and like hindsight is 2020, right?
Yeah.
And I'm sure that then looking back, it's like, oh my gosh, like this all makes sense now in a way that it never did before.
Yes, exactly.
And it sounds like therapy played a huge role in that.
Oh, absolutely. I believe in therapy 100%. Unfortunately, my therapist stopped taking my insurance company, GHI. And so I haven't seen a therapist since December. And I'm starting to look for a new therapist now, because I'm really feeling like, okay, I need to talk to somebody about what I'm going through. I need to continue. I really believe in therapy, because my therapist took me to places where I did not want to go. She would make me reenact scenes. She would make me really talk about certain things that I didn't want to. And I would answer things like, I don't know. And she's like, I'm not going to accept that answer. And she, and to the point where I used to get so annoyed with her, I'd give her an attitude, but she kept through it. She's like, Kathy, you're going to have to do this. You're going to have to go through this. And I'm asking you to go through it. And every single time when she pissed me off, every single time when I turned off when I left my meeting angry with her, like later on, I'd be like, yo, I understand what she was doing. That was pretty good. Okay, I see where she was going with this. And I needed that tough, the way that she dealt with me, I needed that in order to break through some of the things that I couldn't see that I was going through.
And I think that you hit it on the head when you said, like, she took me places I didn't want to go. Mm-hmm. And I think for a lot of people, you know, that feeling's scary,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, it's like, I don't know if I'm capable of this. Like, I don't know if I can.
Yeah.
But if you have somebody who knows what they're doing,
yeah,
and who's a good fit for you,
mm-hmm.
they're going to empower you to believe that you can go there and to know that you're safe now. And, you know, that's been my experience as well, Kathy. I've been in therapy for 13 years off and on. Mm-hmm. I've had many different therapists. Mm-hmm. And every single one of them, it's like they brought something different. I learned something new. And even just like this past, I'm still in therapy. I just had a session a couple of days ago where, you know, she brought something to light that I had just kind of overlooked for myself. And I'm like, I'm a therapist. and I couldn't quite see that, because, you know, we do have a very subjective experience by default in mm-hmm. our life. Mm-hmm. And having that objective, like, let's think critically about this. There's just so much value to that.
Yeah, there really is. There really is. And it's important, because you can talk to your family and friends, and they serve a purpose in helping with your healing journey. I really do believe that, but they're not far away from you and the situation enough to really help you to go to those dark places like an objective therapist is. You know what I mean? And I
exactly
important for me. And at first I remember I used to think, I don't know if I want to continue with her anymore. And I would be to that point, but every week I was back in that chair because I understood that it was helping me with something. If anything, it was helping me to just air out my grievances. You know what I mean?
And I think that's so important, because I believe in the importance of having natural supports. So like having friends or family members that you can talk to, mm-hmm. but like sometimes it's not always maybe ideal or safe to air certain grievances mm-hmm. to our friends or family. One, because some things are meant to be a private experience, mm-hmm. right? Like I don't need to air my grievances with everybody.
Right.
And then also like having that confidentiality and knowing that like whatever I say in this space is never going to leave this space. Mm-hmm. It allows us to be able to express maybe some of those deeper, darker truths that like, I'm not going to feel comfortable. Even my spouse, like I love him so dearly, but there are certain things that, you know, I don't even want to reveal to myself sometimes. Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that is what is very unique about therapy in that aspect of like, this is all protected. Like you can say and feel whatever way you need to in that space.
Yeah. I completely agree with you. I always felt safe to say what was on my mind. I always felt safe to just project. And if I got angry, I knew that she wasn't going to take it personally, that I was just speaking through my feelings. And I always appreciated that. And I felt like that's what I needed at that moment, you know?
Absolutely. And so take us to what this depths of your depression maybe looked like at some points. So were you ever having like thoughts of wanting to harm yourself? Did you ever go inpatient psychiatric? You know, what was that place like for you?
I thought about suicide. I thought about death, but I never had the courage to see it through, you know? And I'm thankful for that, but it was just something that I thought of and I never actually tried. But the thing is with my bouts of depression, they would come on. As I said, my twin sister, who doesn't suffer with depression and who is an extrovert, she always had the friends, she had the boyfriends. And I felt like my lowest points of depression was when she was with her significant other and I didn't have anyone and I was feeling sorry for myself and here she is with her boyfriend and she's happy and I don't have a boyfriend and I want to be happy. And I would get really, really low. I would give her an attitude, give him, her boyfriend an attitude, be angry with myself and be angry with the fact that I was giving them an attitude and why do I have to be like that? There were times when I was in such a low state that I would just cry and cry and cry and I didn't want anyone to know that I was crying and I would and I felt like I was like in such a dark, deep hole that I could not get out of. I felt like there was no way that anyone in the world could ever know what I'm feeling at this moment. I never thought that I would be able to explain what I was feeling to anyone. And I didn't understand why I was feeling this way. So my bouts of depression came at moments when I felt at my lowest when I didn't like something that I had done or something that someone had done to me. And I would just retreat to my room and be by myself and just cry and cry and cry and just feel like, what if I wasn't alive? And what if, you know, they would treat me differently if something bad happened to me. But it was just this never-ending sorrow. I just deep in a deep dark hole that no one could reach down and grab me and help me from it. And even when people try to be like, you know, come on, Kathy, let's go out or let's have some fun or tell me jokes, whatever. I did not want to be there. I did not want to get into that happy place because right now this was my comfortable place. It was my comfort place. This is what I knew. I knew this depression. I didn't know what they were talking about, that happiness over there. No, don't make me go over there. I'm comfortable here, yet I didn't want to be there. So,
And I had that exact same experience of like, it's a fear, right? There's almost like this fear of like, I don't know how to be where you're at. Mm-hmm. And it really does stem from like that comparison place of like, I mean, I had different circumstances. A lot of my comparison was I grew up in poverty. And so I was constantly like, why did I get the short end of the stick? Like, look at all these other people and like mm-hmm. their parents paid for their college and they bought them a car and they have all these things. And comparison was a huge theme for me as mm-hmm. well. Mm-hmm. And I think that like when you're in that place and you're like, you're just not like me. Like, you just don't understand. Like right. you can't understand that sort of, it's a grief, right? It's like this disconnection of yeah. like, how am I, it's hard for me to relate to you
yes.
When you're happy. But I always explain to my clients that our brains are not exactly wired to make us happy. Really, they're wired to keep us safe.
Yes. yes
and safety is predictability, right?
Yeah.
It's, I know this place. It yes. might not be pretty and I might not like it, but I know this place and it yes. feels safe.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. That's exactly what it is.
Yeah. And I feel like, you know, for most of us, that comparison is such a thief of joy. And it's hard to find any amount of contentment when I am just comparing whatever I have to somebody else. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it's a very human thing, right? It's just kind of like how our brains are wired. Like mm-hmm. we like to categorize, we like yeah. to, you know, put people in boxes in a way because that feels safe, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah. yeah.
But at the end of the day, that's also what keeps us disconnected. It's what keeps us in that place.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, that's crazy. And throughout, like I said, throughout my years of experiencing depression, there were times, of course, where I felt completely fine and everything was great. But then when I suffered with those low moments, man, it was just like, I just never felt like there would be any way out. And again, I didn't feel, there was almost something shameful about it. I didn't feel like I could talk to anyone about it. I didn't know how to talk to anybody about it. And yeah, it's crazy.
It's crazy. Yes. And then it sounds like something shifted when your sister was like, listen, we need you to go talk to somebody. You know, I can't help you. I can't kind of get you out of this place.
Yeah.
And then it sounds to me like that's really when you started to feel a shift or feel a change.
Yes, that's when the change did happen because, you know, all that time I think she had told me that I need to talk to somebody, but I never did. But when she started looking for a therapist for me, I was in complete agreement. I said, okay, you know, I just knew this, it's time to do this. And so I felt like the shift was, I was in a place that allowed me to heal. You know what I mean? There are some people who they're not there yet. So you have to wait for them to get there in order to start healing. I was in that place. I felt like this is going to happen. I want to get better. But as I said before, it took quite a few years until I found the therapist that I finally felt happy with. And in that time, I still suffered with bouts of depression from time to time, but you know, they were really, really low at times, but that was a shift because at least I was moving in the right direction. Yeah, absolutely.
Yes. And I think that when it comes to depression, it's almost like we're going to be trending up, right? Like if you think about this on a graph, right? It's like, you know, we're trending up, but then the data points, like it's not like every single day is going to be like up, 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 right? Mm-hmm. Like there's some variability there. And, you know, I have a major depressive disorder diagnosis. I'm mm-hmm. assuming you probably have the same.
Yeah.
And especially when we're living with those types of conditions, I mean, for many of us, it is chronic, right? It is lifelong that we might have maybe those bouts of, okay, well, here's a couple of bad days. But mm-hmm. for me, I have been able to come to a place where I'm like, okay, so like these are some bad days, but it's not a bad life, right? Mm-hmm. Like I can have maybe some of this low energy that comes in sometimes. And you know, even now, 13 years later, I still have that happen to me sometimes. Mm-hmm. But most of the time it's for things that like make sense. It's not like it's like there's something in my life that I need to shift with, or mm-hmm. there's something that I've maybe tolerated that I can't really allow to continue, right. or like along those lines.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. And so I find it interesting how, you know, we as a society are starting to talk about depression now because of the pandemic. And I'm starting to really talk about it myself. Whereas before, like people who knew me, I never disclosed this part of myself. And I felt like all of a sudden I come out as depressive, and I felt sort of like I was sharing something with the world that was supposed to be top secret. Now, how are they going to view me? Now, how are they going to look at me? But I decided to do that as a way for me to get myself through this also, because I feel like there have been a number of things that have helped with my depression, and not just talk therapy. I was on medication for a while, but then when I quit my job and I no longer had insurance, I had to find a different way to help myself that would not that wouldn't be compromised because of my insurance situation. You know what I mean? And so I wasn't really looking for different ways to heal or to help depression, but I found that with talking it out, talk therapy really, really helped, because now I'm able to release some of the feelings that I felt, and I'm able to air them out, and it felt good to do that. But I also started exercising, because my sister exercised a lot, and she was looking really good. And we go to the Twins Festival every year, and we make sure that we look as close as possible as we can. We are fraternal twins, but for the Twins Festival, we want to look as identical as possible, because there are like thousands of twins there who look exactly alike, and we want to be one of those. So I started working out as well. And I didn't even know that a byproduct of working out was to help with my depression, because those first few months when I started working out on a regular basis, I wasn't depressed. I was feeling good about myself. And then my sister, my cousins, and I, you know, did this health challenge, exercise challenge, and where, you know, we competed against one another in groups so that we could exercise every single day. And then we started talking about meditations and listening to affirmations and listening to positive self-talk. And while I did all of this, I was like, oh my gosh, this is really helping me. And for the first time in my life, I felt like I had control over the negative thoughts that ran around in my head. I found that completely by accident.
And you know what, Kathy? I think that so many people don't realize the benefits from exercise. Mm-hmm. But I'm an integrative therapist, and that means that, you know, I work from a mind, body, spirit approach. Mm-hmm. And what I understand about depression is that it is stagnation, right? Mm-hmm. It's that feeling of like, my thoughts are the same. It's day in and day out. Things are just, it's like, there's nothing moving or changing. Right. Mm-hmm. And exercise is the opposite of stagnation, right? Yeah. Like it's literally movement. And for most people who have depression, moving their body for 20, 30 minutes a day, mm-hmm. 3 to 5 days a week, that has just as much as an effect as long-term medication management by itself.
Wow.
And I'm not saying that there aren't benefits to medication, because absolutely, mm-hmm. you know, I've worked inpatient psychiatric. Medication saves lives every single day.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
But medication by itself is not going to change your mindset. Yes. It's not going to change your outlook. Mm-hmm. We need these alternatives as well.
Yeah. It's so true. Because look, you said medication alone is not going to change your mindset. Medication isn't meant to change your mindset. It's meant to alter some chemical imbalance in the brain. Am I correct?
Yes. Yes, it does. It helps to basically slow down the reuptake of serotonin, which we need to have happy feelings, but yeah.
Right. So we have to take it upon ourselves to help to change our mindset. And this, like, I equate it with, like, you know, getting up every morning to brush your teeth. That's a thing that you do. That's everyone, pretty much that's everyone's normal routine. Get up, brush your teeth, you wash your face, you take a shower. That's like your everyday routine. And I had to add on to all of that meditation and affirmations and exercise. I would meditate and do my affirmations in the morning. In the afternoons when I came home from work, I would do my exercise. And this was my daily routine. In the summers when I'm off from teaching, I do all of it in the mornings. You know, I work out in the morning, and this was my regular routine. And I have to do it every single day in order to see the effects every single day. And what's challenging about that is that I would have to do it every single day, you know, because sometimes I realize that if a week goes by and I haven't exercised or meditated, I am starting to feel down and depressed, and it could be anything about anything that's going on in my life at the moment. I happen to harp on that. So it is a challenge for me to do this on a regular basis, but I also know that it has worked for me in the past and it can continue to work for me. I haven't been on medication in over 10 years for depression, and I don't feel like I need it. There are some people who do need it, at least to stabilize themselves before they can start exercising and doing whatever else they need to do. But for me, I feel like I'm one of the lucky ones that I don't need to take that medication. As long as I keep working on my mindset and my exercise, I feel like I can be okay.
Yes. Yeah. And I think that for most people, there comes the excuses. Right? Of like, mm-hmm. I don't have time to mm-hmm. meditate. I don't have time to exercise. I don't have time. Mm-hmm. And I hear that time and time again. Mm-hmm. And my response for that is always, you need to make time for these things like your life depends on it.
Right? Mm-hmm.
Pretend like your life depends on this, because truthfully, it very well may one day.
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, truthfully, if you look at the research, if you look at the data, the number one predictor of disease, it's not what you eat. It's not what you smoke or what you drink. It's stress.
Mm.
That's what it is. Wow. And unless we are proactively dealing with the stressors by moving our bodies and, you know, and changing our mindset and doing the affirmation, doing the meditation, I mean, your life really does depend on it in a way.
Can I ask you something, Courtney? So I know that I was on a Facebook group for people who suffer with depression, and I wrote down that I exercise, and that's one of the things that I do that really helps me. And there were a number of people who wrote back, but I'm just so exhausted. I'm always tired. I can't get up. I don't even have the energy to get up, much less exercise. Like, what would you say to that person who really, and I understand it, I get it, because depression really lowers your energy so much to the point where you physically cannot get out of bed. So how does someone get out of that, you know, stagnation?
Yes. And that's a very fair point. And I treat a number of individuals who fall in that category. Mm-hmm. So as an integrative therapist, I am going to encourage that person to very incrementally just, can I move myself 1% more than I normally do? Can I just sit in my bed in the morning and stretch a little bit? Can I start by just reaching for my toes, or, you know, maybe doing a little bit of twists, just sitting up, just sitting in my bed. There's also a number of Qigong body movements. They're of an Eastern tradition, and they are very simple things like chest thumping, right? It's kind of like you're literally just kind of like thumping your chest and almost like a, like an ape, right? Who would like thump its chest. Or you can do like arm slapping, which is just kind of going up and down the arm. Or just like gentle shaking, like shaking the arms, shaking the legs, literally anything to just sort of get the body moving in a new or a different way. It's really that novelty. It's like, okay, this is different, right?
Yeah.
It kind of just starts to create the momentum that we need in order to begin that shift.
Wow. That's cool. Okay. Yeah. Because I understand that exercise is not for everybody. And I myself, I when I started exercising, I just felt like I did not have that time during the day. And so I worked out for 10 minutes a day. And then after a while, I was like, okay, well, it takes me just as much time to put on my workout clothes than it does to for me to work out. So let me just do it 20 minutes a day. And then I upped it to 30 minutes a day. And, you know, so I started off on on a much smaller scale myself. And then I realized that I actually enjoyed the workouts. I enjoyed the way I started looking. So that was another thing that helped my mood. I started looking nicer. You know, I liked the way my body looked. So I was just like, oh, let me continue the workouts. And during my workouts, I did only the ones, of course, that I enjoyed, because there was some work I only did the workouts that I really enjoyed, that I felt good doing. And that made me feel good that I was accomplishing something. So that helped my mood as well. I was able to get through it. So.
Yeah. Because you set attainable goals.
Yes.
Right.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Goals that when you hit them, then reinforce, hey, look, I can do this.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So tell me, Kathy,
how
has your life shifted since you have been able to find these things that have helped alleviate the depression? Where are you at today? What does your life look like today?
So that's a very good question. I think I have a lot more confidence in myself as an individual, as a writer. I started writing a book in my 20s when I wanted to understand my depression. So I started writing a book about a girl who suffered with depression, and that book, although I felt like it was done, was on the back burner for the last 20 years. And I finally picked it back up. I had an editor go through it. I revised it according to my editor. And at first I thought I was going to self-publish it. Then I started querying agents. And then now I'm back to, let me just self-publish it. Let me just get it out there now as a self-published book, because I've been talking a lot on different podcasts and on different platforms about depression. And it would be great if I had this book to be like, hey, this is what came from my depression. So, you know, I wish I had already self-published it so that I could, you know, sell it or give it out as a way to tell people something good can come from such a low point in your life. And so I decided, you know what, I'm not going to look for an agent anymore, because it could be a very, very long process. I'm going to publish my book. So and that in itself is helping me get over my imposter syndrome. It's helping me improve with my confidence. So where I am now is that I'm not focusing on my depression as much as I used to, because now I'm focusing on the healing aspect. And part of that healing is letting people hear my story, writing about it on my blog, where I talk about it's about my positive perspective about what I go through with depression. So what my life looks like now is getting the word out there about depression, about how you can make yourself feel better, about the different ways in which you can make yourself feel better, and what good thing can come out of this horrific, debilitating condition. So that's where I am now.
And here's the thing, what divine timing. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know there's probably part of this like, man, I wish I maybe put this out earlier, but yeah. I challenge that a little bit in saying that we are finally really talking about this on more of this collective level where it's not as stigmatized as it once was.
You're right.
So maybe more people are going to be able to pick it up and relate to it in a way that they couldn't have 10, 15, 20 years ago.
That's a good point. You're right. Yeah. You're right.
So, well, Kathy.
Yes.
I would love for you to just sort of outline for the audience, list off some of the different tools. I know you've mentioned a couple here and there, mm-hmm. but what have been the biggest factors in helping you to live with and cope with depression?
My writing. One of the things that I tell everybody is find that thing that your superpower. I think writing is my superpower. Find that superpower, that thing that you know you can't really live without, right? That thing that creative that gets your creative juices flowing, that thing that puts you on a higher plane, that it doesn't matter all the other things that are going in life, as long as you are there. It could be gardening, it could be singing, writing music, watching TV, certain movies. Find that thing that helps elevate you to that happier level where it could actually put you in a mood where you can get things done, where you could start feeling better about yourself and being productive. I think that's so important. Like more so than the exercise, my writing, I feel, has saved me. Even like I write so much that so much of it is not meant for anybody else's eyes. They're meant for me, but it's what I've done to help me get through this as well. So find that superpower, find that thing that will help you with overcoming your affliction, including, and that's not going to be the only thing, because I have like a cocktail of things, right? I have my writing, I have exercise, affirmations, meditations, and positive self-talk. And I watch a lot of Disney movies, so I'm good.
I love the Disney movies.
Aren't they great?
What's your favorite?
The Lion King, but the original animated movie.
Yes.
Yes. So good. So yes. Good.
OG Lion King will yes. always be the best. Yes,
exactly.
Not yeah. that I don't love the remakes, you know. The remake Queen Bee and everything. That was great, but
you can't beat the original.
Yeah.
And
I think that really it's like having that variety there, right? Like some days maybe we might not have the energy to like go for a run or whatever to combat exactly. our depression, but exactly. we can put on a movie that makes us laugh.
Yes. Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Kathy, if anybody yeah. wants to follow you, learn a little bit more about you, tell us how we can do that and maybe some of the ways that they could work with you.
Sure. You can find me on Instagram. That's where I promote my blog. My Instagram is Kathy_Marie1, the number one. And my blog is kathyscross.wordpress.com. And again, it's just how I, that blog is Kathy, it's Kathy's positive perspective. It's how I really reflect on my experience with depression and anxiety and how I try to flip it and try to see a positive perspective from it. So.
Wonderful. Well, I am excited to hop on and check out some of your blogs.
Thank you.
And I am so grateful that you took the time to share your story with my audience.
Thank you so much for inviting me, Courtney. I really appreciated it. I listened to some of your previous, some of your episodes, and I really felt like this was a podcast that I want to be a part of. So thank you so much for inviting me.
Wow, everybody. I hope that you enjoyed Kathy's story of nonlinear healing. If you've enjoyed this episode, make sure that you share with others and tag us on social media. It's how we get the word out about this podcast, and leave a review as well. We appreciate every single person who takes a moment to share and review this podcast. That's how we help reduce the stigma. It's by sharing our stories and inspiring others to help cultivate healing and change the dynamics when it comes to mental illness. So once again, thank you so much for tuning into Nonlinear Healing with Courtney Brook. We'll see you next week, and have a blessed week. Bye now.